Hello everybody, my name is Bezena Hinton and I'd like to introduce you and welcome you to the session on UniSuper's approach to risk budgeting, which will be presented by David Schneider. David will give a brief presentation and then it'll be followed by a time for questions. We've got the microphone in the middle of the room, so please come up and speak into the microphone and say your name at the same time. I encourage you to make lots of comments on the paper. There's a lot of interesting stuff in there and I really look forward to David's presentation. Just tell you a little bit about David. David has primary responsibility for the research and risk management area within UniSuper's investment department and manages the fund's strategic asset allocation, strategic tilting, investment research and corporate government functions. UniSuper is a superannuation fund for Australia's higher education sector and is one of Australia's largest superannuation funds. UniSuper has approximately $21 billion in funds under management, with over 419,000 members and over 150 fund managers and direct investments held. UniSuper has an open defined benefit plan and a defined contribution plan that offers members a range of diversified and single asset class options to choose from. Before joining UniSuper in December 2005, David was a partner at Deloitte's Actuarial and Insurance Solutions Office in Gaborone, Botswana. Prior to that, David was the Managing Director of Actuarial Solutions, the first actuarial consulting agency in Botswana. During his time in Botswana, David was the valuator for the Botswana Public Offices Pension Fund, as well as several life offices and pension funds in sub-Saharan Africa. David developed the first Varima model for Botswana and conducted extensive research and modelling into the demographic, epidemiological and financial impact of HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. David has served on several research and professional bodies, including acting as the convener of the Actuarial Society of South Africa's AIDS Committee, as well as an executive member of the South African Centre for Epidemiological Modelling and Analysis. Please welcome David Schneider.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me? All right, yep. It's not a big room, so we should be all right. Today I'm going to speak about UniSuper's approach to risk budgeting. And just to put things in context, it's important to understand that UniSuper, as was mentioned earlier, has $21 billion in assets under management. And those assets are managed between public and private markets. And on the public market side, we make use of a manager of managers approach. Private market side, we have some direct investments, and we also make use of pooled funds and managers in that area as well. Okay, so with that introductory comment, today I will discuss the objectives, goals, and processes that we used in setting our risk budgeting framework. I'll spend quite a bit of time talking about the interaction between the strategic asset allocation and risk budgeting, and that's unusual because you don't normally hear that type of interaction in most risk budgeting work, but I thought it was quite important. For CPD requirements, I have to present several equations, but the workings for those equations are in the appendix. What I'll do, though, is I'll try and explain them from a first principles perspective. What do the equations actually mean? What are they trying to tell us? I believe risk budgeting is an important process for funds to follow and, like most models, should be used but not trusted or believed. As such, risk budgeting generates the framework for discussion. And I'm going to spend quite a bit of time talking about the types of questions we ask when we look at the results. And finally, I open the floor to some questions. Okay, so for those who don't know, and I'm sure everyone's read the paper, and I actually have a nod, that's impressive, yeah, that's good. risk budgeting, like any other form of a budget, is a process where we try and set target levels of risk that we'll accept for a fund manager, for example, and in UniSuper's case, by option. We try and then allocate that risk across various investment managers and styles, for example, and we attempt to do things like maximize returns whilst containing risk to that preset budget. And traditionally, that's been done via tracking errors. Yet, I felt that tracking errors really didn't work well for UniSuper. So I was uncomfortable with that approach. And it makes sense for a fund manager, because often they have mandates where they have to manage their business to a maximum tracking error. So effectively their liability becomes the tracking error. But when you actually are responsible for the liabilities and for defined benefit liabilities, for example, guaranteed liabilities, that process just seems arbitrary and superficial to me. But the benefit of risk budgeting is it does ensure that you think actively about distributing your risk by manager, by style, and by asset classes. This graphic summarizes the types of risks faced by UniSuper, and some of them have already been discussed in prior presentations at this convention. But to start with, UniSuper has both defined benefit liabilities. We have an open defined benefit plan. And there are liabilities, effectively the assets are there to ensure that we meet those liabilities as they fall due. We also have accumulation options. And our job there is to ensure that we give a sufficient range of options for our members to choose, stratified by risk and return. We have sufficient number of options to meet different CPI objectives. And we get those option asset class mixes as close to an efficient frontier as possible. We have to invest in assets to meet these liabilities, and that means that we incur both external and internal risks. Examples of external risks are market risks, which we all know about given the recent global financial crisis, but there are also issues such as regulatory risks, suppliers' risks. Internally, we have risks obviously relating to things like the quality of the board, the various committees, management, and we have a range of strategic risks as well. For example, are there any unintended style biases that we have within our portfolio? It is not within the scope of this paper and this presentation to discuss all these risks. I'm focusing only on one. The risk budgeting only focuses on that area of risk. So before anyone asks me, could the risk budgeting framework have spotted the global financial crisis and the dangers of that? The answer is no. Would be nice if it could. That would be handled in other areas of our risk management policy. Okay. But it is one component and a reasonably important component in the total risk management framework. About 2 years ago, I was given the mandate to develop the risk budgeting framework for the fund. And I thought that would be quite a simple process. What I'll do is I'll look what all the suppliers are offering, I'll read the odd paper, and I'll try and find a supplier that generates a reasonably cheap product which we can then just purchase and utilize. But the more I read, the more I came to the conclusion that the products that we were being developed weren't appropriate for a fund like UniSuper. And to me, a key risk, and I know it's a bit of a shocker, but the key risk is just not meeting that liability when it falls due. So I thought that the risk budget should be tied to the liabilities in some manner. My other concern was a lot of risk budgeting work is focusing on attribution. We know that a particular option generated or manager generated a specific amount of risk, volatility of returns. We try and attribute that between stocks or managers if you're at a fund level. I was more interested in risk allocation. Where should we put the money? Also have other things I have to worry about. We have alternatives within our portfolio. We make use of strategic tilting where we deliberately move away from strategic asset allocation benchmarks. And we have operational concerns that we need to consider all the time, such as rebalancing, which was discussed in a paper yesterday. Not for UniSuper, but rebalancing policies. And Sid's nodding over there. And finally, I felt that the risk budgeting framework should give us an insight as to how we would actively change the portfolio. So it shouldn't just be a reporting tool. I decided on the following six processes that I felt, and again, I was just trying to abstract work out what should the framework do. And I thought it would be useful if I could get the following six things done. One, if I could split returns between a beta and an alpha. So the beta would be an asset class type of return, almost an economic rental for investing, in harvesting an economic rental from investing in an asset class. And the leftover stuff, the alpha, the idiosyncratic risk, or the excess return by managers, I wanted that split out per manager. There's lots of work that's been done on that in the literature, but there are problems with collinearity and co-integration as well. And in the paper, in the appendix, I describe an algorithm that we developed to help overcome those problems. The next step was to compare each option's beta, or for the defined benefit division, the strategic asset allocation, to that which we're actually observing from the managers. So if, for example, all our managers are high beta managers, we might end up with in equity space, for example, we might actually end up with more equity risk than we thought we had. That's simple return attribution, done frequently in the literature as well. The third step I wanted to do, or process, was to derive or determine the historic variance per option. Very simply done, and the marginal proportional contribution of each manager or each asset to that risk has also been done previously in the literature. So a very simple step. The fourth process was to determine the ex ante alpha, or forecast alpha, from each manager that we would have estimated, or from each asset for direct investments. That was a lot harder, but fortunately some excellent work done by Black and Linneman in 2002 and then extended in 2003 by Winkelmann gave me an indication as to how to do that. So the first four processes were effectively already done in the literature. The next two, though, were new ideas that we try to tackle. How do I set a minimum hurdle for each option's active risk? We've already said that an arbitrary tracking error just doesn't make sense. So I had to try and overcome that problem. And finally, having overcome that problem, having found that minimum hurdle, can I find a better, in inverted commas, manager lineup or asset class lineup, an optimal lineup, as it were? So those were the challenges I set myself. Okay. This is simple mean variance optimization. And for those that don't know, and I'm sorry if I'm lecturing to the converted here, the y-axis represents returns. The x-axis represents standard deviation of annual returns. So it's almost like a Markowitz-type framework, except that what we have here is we don't have equities and cash. We have all asset classes. The light blue line represents the unconstrained efficient frontier. But we have certain constraints at UniSuper. For example, there's a no-shorting constraint. In addition, we limit the amount of alternative assets that we can put into the portfolio because of illiquidity risks and because we have some concerns as to the assumptions behind those particular asset classes. And that generates, the constraints that we use generate this dark blue curve over here. And this is actual constraints and actual data. This is our best estimate currently for each of our various accumulation options. The green dots represent the diversified options that we have within UniSuper, and the red dots, we allow our members to select single asset class options, and they're clearly less efficient. And I imagine the first question that everyone's going to be asking me is, why does the balanced option, the growth option, why aren't they closer to the efficient frontier? Well, the reason is that this is a simplified presentation as to mean and variance of returns. I believe that there are more moments we have to worry about. For example, there's skewness and kurtosis that we have to think about very carefully. And in addition, very importantly, these are single-year standard deviation of returns. Our balance option has a six-year time horizon. So I actually look at serial correlation in a lot of detail. And if you look at six-year average standard deviation of returns, then the balance option gets much closer to the efficient frontier, but it's a different frontier. However, for this framework and for this representation, it's useful to look in single-year standard deviation space. Okay, so we all know this. We have our efficient frontier. We overlay that with some kind of a utility function or risk tolerance or whatever other objective, and that's how we set our strategic asset allocation for the various options. Lots of mathematics and lots of actuarial science goes into these calculations, and for the defined benefit even more because we have to worry about the liabilities as well. And then what we do is we stop all of that, we put it to the side, and we introduce active risk. So I thought, well, what does active risk look like in mean variance space? Well, the good news is that after fees, alpha can be positive or negative. And alpha can, and usually does, increase risk. Or it can actually be negative. It can reduce risk because it could be uncorrelated to the other assets. So what we had was our beautiful frontier created in mean variance space getting smudged and blurred by alpha. Now, that's not a great experience for some of us purists in the room. So I thought, well, what does that mean to my strategic asset allocation? The very scientific, carefully derived allocation that I've worked so hard on is getting contaminated by alpha. And what we're really doing is we're adding active risk to the portfolio. That struck me as being strange. So I thought, well, how can I overcome that problem? And I think the easiest way is, well, why don't I just reduce the beta risk within the portfolio, so reduce equities, increase bonds, for example, then add active risk. and get me back to the same position, and I'm neutral. I've achieved nothing, but at least I'm back to where I started. However, therein lies a key inequality. The expected alpha divided by the standard deviation impact on your risk of your portfolio must be greater than a derivative of the efficient frontier at that point in time to justify going alpha, going active. Otherwise, you should remain passive. So I'll just quickly say that a different way. The derivative of the efficient frontier effectively represents your minimum required information ratio. If you cannot get that information ratio, forecast it, because no one knows in advance, then one should remain passive. This is an unusual result, because we've always been taught that as long as alpha is positive after fees, it's justifiable. Let's go a little bit further with this idea. So we have over here the unconstrained frontier. I'm not sure if you can see it. It's a light blue line. And we have the dark blue line over here being the constrained frontier. And if we look at the high growth option, for example, the slope is pretty shallow. It's about 0.2. So your required information ratio to go active is moderate. It's achievable, 0.2. But for the capital stable, it's closer to 0.5. And for the cash option, which is right over there, it's about 4. Unattainable. So this immediately gives us a bit of an insight as to whether or not we should go active and whether it's appropriate to go active for certain asset classes options. In addition, have a look at the derivative of the unconstrained efficient frontier. It's much, much higher. So the more constraints we add, the more appropriate it is to look to add alpha. Another way of looking at that problem is instead of adding alpha, maybe release or remove some of your constraints. And there's a third interesting insight on this. Have a look at currency hedging, which is the exact opposite to active management. In currency hedging, you incur a hedging cost. But you also enjoy a reduction in volatility. What that suggests is that being 100% hedged for growth assets internationally for your low-risk options is more justifiable than for your high-risk options. Possibly that's suggesting that the strategic currency hedge ratio should vary by option. That's not something we're doing at Unisuper. We're still exploring those ideas, but I think it's an interesting insight. Okay, so we're going to now move away from graphics and move towards equations, but I'm going to try and keep it very high level, and for those that do crave the detail, it is in the appendix. All right, a manager's returns can be decomposed, and this has been done since APT, into a beta stream and an alpha stream over there, plus an error. The beta streams can then be contrasted to the fund's actual benchmarks and strategic asset allocation. The alpha is an ex post alpha. It's a historic alpha. But I'm going to propose a certain method to convert that to a forecast alpha, and I can assess the ex ante alpha, and I can check to see if that beats that minimum hurdle. Remember the derivative of the efficient frontier. I can also try and use this information to try and find some kind of an optimal manager lineup, because clearly it's going to need to know what the expected return is for each manager. I can look at the managers and how they interact between each other, and I can get the covariance of returns from that. Now, there's an interesting point of departure that we've made here relative to many other authors. Many authors assume that the alpha, the excess returns, are independent between managers. That seems correct. But in my mind, that's not true, and the data supports my view. And the reason is, if you have two value managers, they tend to both do well together. Two quant managers will do poorly together as well. So they're highly correlated, pairwise correlations are high between different styles. So I don't make that simplifying assumption, and I look at the observed covariance to compute, I need that for the hurdle and for the manager lineup optimization, but also compute the marginal proportional contributions to risk and tracking error. And finally, and this is actually quite an important step, I look at the errors in a lot of detail. I want to get a sense, because the errors, the distribution of the residuals, are actually the distribution of the alpha. So I use that to get a sense as to whether there's any serial correlation, kurtosis, or skewness within that distribution. For those that are interested in the paper, we actually have a worked example, which people can go through to see how we actually apply this in practice. So let's put this in Greek notation, if we may. If mu I represents manager I's returns at time t, and manager I operates in asset class AI, then manager I's returns can be decomposed into an alpha plus a series of beta factors. And so, for example, if it's an Australian share manager, there'll be an ASX 300 factor, a value factor, a growth factor, small cap factor. And the betas would be their correlation to that particular factor, plus an error term. So we're saying something very simple. We can decompose managers' returns between alpha, beta, and an error. That's been well documented in the literature. But let's go one step further. Those factors are in turn correlated to the fund's benchmarks. So what we can do is we can take the factors, and for example, let's take a growth manager, a growth factor. What you'd find is a growth factor has a slightly higher beta than the index as a whole, but might have a negative risk premium. So the growth factor might have, say, 102% of the ASX 300 minus 0.2% per annum plus another error term, Vega. By putting it all together and combining all my managers and assets together, I can work out what my option returns have been like. Sorry, you can see over here the factors basically represent an extraneous risk premium, the benchmark correlation, and an error term. And as I said before, we can combine all our managers together. And this equation looks messy, but it's actually quite a simple equation. What we're saying is that the return from each option is a weighted average of the ex post alphas of each of our managers, plus the components that correlate directly to our benchmarks, plus another set of beta that we don't necessarily know what that is, and we need to make sure we understand, plus an error term. And that error term is a weighted average of the extraneous risk premia and each of the managers' alpha distributions. Okay, so that's the return attribution. The next stage was looking at the ex ante alpha estimation. And here we use the Black-Litterman model. Now, this equation looks really scary. And this is an adaptation of Black-Litterman's work, but it's actually really, really simple. And it's one of those statements that I call equations, I call it equation, because it really is a simple one. If you think about it, when you're taking a view as to how you expect your managers to perform, you'd want to combine somehow their historic performance with your opinion about how that manager is going to perform. And all Black and Litterman did was they came up with a very clever way of presenting that. And we adapted that work slightly in our paper and got to this equation. So what we have is this represents a vector of ex ante alphas for each of our managers. The Q vector represents our views. So if we think manager 1 will outperform by 1.5%, the first element in that vector will be 1.5%. And the capital A vector is the historic performance. So what we actually have is the alpha is a weighted average of the historic performance and our views. And let's have a look at those weights. The first weight is an omega matrix, which is effectively just a square matrix with the off diagonals equal to zero and the diagonal elements representing the variance of our view, or as the literature calls it, the confidence in the view. Technically, it is actually the variance of the view. And in the paper, I give a practical method on how to derive that, because it's actually non-trivial. I've discovered this when trying to derive it myself, hitting a brick wall for a couple of days. But anyway, it's in the paper if you're interested. And the second set of weights, which apply to the capital A vector, the psi vector, represents the covariance matrix that we've already derived elsewhere. There is also a parameter tau. It's actually a highly controversial parameter. It's not that sensitive, but for the purists and anyone that's worked with Black-Litterman, it is an important assessment, and I give some commentary as to the practical findings that we had or thoughts we have with tau, and one of our findings is that tau should be pretty close to 1. Okay, so what we have is a simple model to derive ex ante alpha being a weighted average of historic alpha and our forecast views, and where the weights are our confidence in those views and the tracking error that the manager has incurred in the past. Very simple. Now we get to the reverse optimization, and this is the last equation, so please bear with me. So what we then went about doing was trying to determine, could we find a better lineup of managers? And by better, I mean, can we find a lineup of managers that generates the highest information ratio, in fact, high enough to justify not being passive, if you recall that derivative of the efficient frontier earlier. And this is that vector. So W star is now our vector of optimal manager weights. This is just a constant over here. Actually, it's more than a constant. It's got an important interpretation. But for now, just think of it as a constant. And that's just another constant. And this here represents alpha over sigma squared. It's just the information ratio for that manager in ex ante view, forward view. So it's from that Black-Litterman model adjustment divided by that manager's tracking error. Okay, very simple. And this function over here is just the information ratio,
our forecast information ratio squared.
If you recall, the derivative of the efficient frontier
was our target information ratio, or our required information ratio to justify active management.
So the denominator is just the difference in squares between what we had to achieve and what we did achieve. And a very similar story is happening on the numerator side as well, which means that the W star vector is nothing other than a function of actual and required information ratios.
A very intuitive type of response, although the equation does look quite messy and it's a matrix equation, which never makes things easier.
All right, so that comes to the end of the technical side, so we can all breathe a bit of a sigh of relief and focus on some of the kind of important questions that we would be asking when we conduct this type of analysis. The types of questions we ask are things like, and there's a list over here, and you're welcome to read them, are we going to get a contamination of our strategic asset allocation? Is one of our managers, for example, shorting Australian Real Estate Investment Trust, AREITs, or LPTs, when we expected an SAA exposure? So that's something we could check for. What kind of confidence do we have in our manager's ability to generate alpha? And do we have we given them the right amount of money given our confidence? So if we have a low confidence manager and they have a large proportion in our portfolio, does that make sense? When we do the reverse optimization, one of the things that comes up quite clearly is that the model loves enhanced passive mandates. These generate small alphas with very, very low tracking errors, hence extremely high information ratios. Does that tell us something that we can actually use? Is there value? Is there information in that result? But I must also stress that whilst the reverse optimization is interesting, and as I said earlier, with regards to risk budgeting in general, models should be used and not necessarily trusted, the model would miss things like concentration of risk in managers, operational risks, and the view that we have as to the process they've adopted. For example, any staff changeover, it's the kind of thing the model would just not pick up. So we look at it in detail, and we use this as a framework for thinking. So to quickly summarize, we followed 7 steps. We de-aggregated each of the manager's returns into different factors. We contrasted those different beta factors to our strategic asset allocation. We derived a forecast view of each manager or each asset. We determined the marginal contribution to risk from each of our managers. We tried to play around to see if we could find a better lineup of managers, and we used that as a framework to check that we have an active program that we're comfortable with, and if we weren't comfortable, if we couldn't meet that minimum requirement or that derivative of the efficient frontier, that means something had to change, because if we couldn't, we'd have to go passive, because that should be the default position. And we spent a lot of time studying that error composition to make sure that there's no unintended kurtosis or serial correlation within the portfolio, even though these are historic data, they do give us an indication as to what could be happening in the future. And finally, and this is where the science stops and the art begins, we interpret the results and think about what it actually means for the portfolio. So I now open the floor to questions, and hopefully we're okay with time. And these are 2 of the screenshots, although you can't really see them. They do look a lot prettier if you've got better resolution.